Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I have a cool show for you called Some Good Student Loan News. Apologies to John Krasinski. That's where I got the idea from. If y'all haven't already, check out his YouTube series, SGN. It's pretty hilarious. It's definitely helped my wife and I in a physician household get through some of these kind of depressing times. And today, to get us some more positive energy, I have our consultant Megan Landris joining us on the show today. How you doing, Megan?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
So I am the king of awkward intros, right? Golly, I just can't. I try to be funny and I just fall flat on my face. So we'll try to entertain people better than I did in the first minute of today's podcast with some really interesting stories that you've come to share with us today. Why don't you just start off telling people just how things are going right now for you? Like, what is life like for you right now? How are you handling this quarantine life? Just tell us a little bit about that first before we dive into some of these interesting stories you have.
Sure. I've been rocking my bathrobe and a couple different Shaws lately, where I barely, I don't get dressed when I'm working from home. I know there's an argument that's on social media, like if folks get all dolled up to be more productive or to feel more productive. I am not that person. I feel like I'm just as productive when I'm in my robe. I'm actually probably more productive because I'm warmer, I'm more comfortable, I could sit longer. So that's what I've been doing. I've been just playing very low key. I've been cooking a lot of experimenting going on in my kitchen since.
Yeah, the dark secret of student loan planner consultants. There's a reason we don't turn the video on, people. I'm just
100%.
I'm just kidding. Okay, I'm just kidding. All right. Gym shorts and a t-shirt sometimes. I will admit that that's my uniform of choice a lot of times.
Yeah.
What's your favorite like house shoes for this? Like that's like been a big thing that I've seen.
Oh gosh. Yeah. My boyfriend makes so much fun of me, but I have these, they're Christmas. It's like the candy cane stripes. They're these fat socks. So they're not even like slippers, but they're just fat and they're fuzzy and they're candy cane stripes. And I love them. And I wear them throughout the house all day. And so that's something I've been wearing.
Yeah.
What so about like, you?
Well, so my wife is Canadian, Asian American, right? And apparently in Canadian households and in Asian American households, shoes are not a thing. You are not supposed to wear shoes. I grew up in a very Southern household where it's like, dirt? What's the difference between dirt outside and dirt inside? You know,
that was me.
And yeah, I mean, I think it's just like, and I've realized too that like a lot of people in like just the Northern part of the United States have a very shoes off mindset. I don't think I've met a single person where I grew up that took their shoes off inside. Mm-hmm. And so now you talk about sacrificing things for love. Okay, anybody out there that's been a shoes on person in their life, you will know that taking your shoes off in the household every single time is the ultimate sacrifice. Okay, it is the ultimate gift. And so I went on this Facebook group that's for dads married to doctors. And I just asked, guys, I'm struggling. What would you recommend to keep my feet comfy during this? I understand that some people are sacrificing their lives and like people are losing their jobs and stuff. I understand. I know that the pain out there is real, but I just want comfortable feet. Okay. Because these wooden floors are just killing me because I can't wear my shoes. And they said, well, there was a real mixed level of feeling. So basically I settled on these $20 pair for Amazon. And I have to say it's okay. It's okay. I will say I am really looking forward to going to the brick and mortar shoe store at the end of all of this and buying some old man orthotic shoes or something to have the most comfortable feet in the world. People ask me, what are you looking forward to at the end of coronavirus? I'm looking forward to comfortable feet.
That's funny.
That was a great intro to a podcast to talk about some good student loan news. And the reality is people are still saving money out there in a big way. You know, if I sum up the amount of money that we've projected to save people in April, and I like to say projected because it's not like we literally wave the magic wand and that amount of money is gone off your debt. It's just like, this is the amount that we're projecting that our advice specifically was responsible for saving people. So not what people were already doing, but it looks like for April, we saved people projected over $6 million.
Oh, nice. That's a nice number.
Yeah. So that's pretty good. 6 million on, so that's like average savings, I think of like in the, you know, $40,000 per person range, something like that. And there's a huge range around that. And yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit today because some people, you know, that have no clue that PSLF is a thing, talk to us and save a projected like $200,000. And then, you know, some people talk to us and have really optimized a lot of things, but they didn't know about which subsidy they should do and how, and that's smaller, a lot smaller savings, but it still pays for the consult a lot. So anyways, like, let's just start off. You brought a lot of stories to tell us.
Yeah.
Which one would you want to talk about first?
Well, I have a few clean it up stories where there's just a lot going on, a lot of different things that are soaking up cash flow. So does that sound like a good starting point to you?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that popped in my head was, you know, somebody's got a 2 and a 4 year old and they're on day 50 of quarantine and they've got just toys all over the living room and they'd do anything just to simplify their life and get cleanliness back and orderliness back to their situation. Are you saying that we can do that for people's student loans?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have two cases that were really cool that really simplified things for their overall finances. But the first one I'll talk about, so this first couple were both PSLF eligible. They both were working at nonprofit entities. But I think some of the media outlets scared them away from even trying to pursue PSLF, but they had the right type of loans. They were both on, well, one was on a standard 10-year plan, which technically counts towards PSLF. You wouldn't want to be on it for the length of the term, though, because you'd pay it all off before you reach forgiveness. And the other was on an income-driven plan already. So they already had potentially some qualifying payments racked up. They just weren't actively pursuing it. They also had separate servicers because they weren't filing those employer certification forms. Their loans weren't all at FedLoan. And so spouse one had like two different servicers for their federal loans. Spouse two, I think, had two as well. So they were paying a lot of different entities, and that could have been simplified by just moving them to FedLoan to start working towards PSLF. And so we started doing the numbers, and with one person being on the standard 10-year and one being on the income-driven plan and them filing joint, you know, the person on the income-driven plan was having the brunt of the joint income payment, or that household payment, because it wasn't being split between spouses. And the other spouse with the standard 10-year plan had a pretty high payment because it was based on paying it all off in 10 years. And so when we combined them, you know, when we looked at jumping on an income-driven plan for both of them and pursuing PSLF, we basically cut their payment in half. And, you know, we simplified their situation by eliminating two or three other servicers, which was nice. And to add to the complexity of this case, they also had private loans with two different servicers. One spouse had one servicer, the other spouse had another servicer at not great interest rates. And they were able to successfully refinance right before all of this got really crazy. And so they were able to refinance, reduce their interest cost over time. They actually shortened their time frame for when they'd be out of debt. And then this isn't student loan related, but we talked about credit card debt. We talked about how paying that off would be a priority. And we opened up cash flow to be able to throw towards it with simplifying their payment situation. And they are now credit card debt free, which is really exciting. That was probably my favorite email this month.
Wow, that's awesome. So it sounds like it was just chaos. Like their personal finances were really in chaos, where there was so many different people at the table. There was nobody giving centralized help to their overall picture, right?
Yeah, it was almost like they were looking at their situations independently, even though obviously they're married and they operate their household budget under the same house. So I thought the simplicity was really awesome to be able to achieve for them.
Why wasn't the servicer involved in giving them that advice?
That's laughable. They're not planners. They're there to take orders. They're not planners.
You know, I'm kind of asking tongue in cheek a little bit, but why is that? Why are they not planners? Why do you think that those servicers didn't do what was in their best interest and tell them about lowering their payments, if not recognizing that they were not-for-profit employees?
Yeah, well, I think they benefit from that, because if they're not pursuing PSLF, if they're not taking advantage of an income-driven plan for a household, they're paying more over time. They're paying a lot more when you crunch out the numbers. And each of those entities was getting a piece, you know? Money was going a lot of different directions, and each of those entities was getting a little bite of it.
That's a good point, because a lot of times people don't realize like the servicers basically get paid the same amount of money if you have 20,000 of debt than if you have, I think, 200,000. I think it's kind of a similar payment from the government to the servicer. So the servicer loses your revenue stream if you ask to be transferred to federal loan servicing. So we've had some people tell clients, oh, don't apply for PSLF. Like, you can just keep your loans with us the full time, and then you send over the application at the end of the 10 years, which is awful advice. Like, that's really bad advice, because we know that Fed loan servicing is really prone to losing people's certified credit all the time if you're not certifying it once a year.
Right.
Have you had that happen?
I was to say, I had someone tell me that the person they were on the phone with at their servicer told them that they don't even process the forms, the employer certification forms, unless you've been working for 5 years or more.
And which
is crazy. I was like, yeah. They literally told you that. And she said, yeah, I took notes. Yep.
I mean, out of fairness, like, I don't think the person was lying. I think they just made something up.
Mm.
Most of the incorrect examples of things that I've heard are it's just some phone rep that just goes up the reservation and just like says something wild.
Yeah.
Just isn't accurate. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll just say something just because it gets you off the phone and makes them have a less stressful day.
Right. Maybe shortens their call time average.
Yeah. I mean, I actually did get a look into this. Like, at the very beginning of my career, I rotated through a call center environment at a big company. And I was fascinated because it seemed like things always go back and forth between hold time, like call time on the phones, and then quality of the answer given. Like, mm-hmm. It seems like every call center ever just goes back and forth between quality of the answers given and how long the people are on the phones. And that's pretty fascinating, because that's at a company where they actually had like a per customer lifetime value, and they had people, customers they were trying to attract and retain and keep. They had business and sales goals for the people they were interacting with. Whereas a servicer, one of the reasons the system's broken is that everyone is sort of a captive audience. The only way to leave your servicer is by saying that you're eligible for PSLF or consolidating your loans or refinancing. Consumers don't have any choice. And when consumers don't have any choice, I think the only thing becomes, what's the average time on the phone that you're having with someone? That average, it's called AHT, average handle time. It's like the number one statistic of any call center, because it determines headcount. And then headcount in a call center is just like 90% of the expense, because then you have to hire more people. You have to have a larger corporate office building to put people in chairs. So I think that that's a really fascinating thing to just know and think about, is what are the incentives at play here? It's absolutely not to give you good advice. Like, I mean, we, I guess, self-interestedly joke about this, Megan, about like, why should people ever have to pay for student loan advice? It should always be free. I mean, there's a little bit of that like kind of attitude out there. I mean, it's, you know, I understand where people are coming from, right? Because you have a lot of like self-directed investment places and places I loved getting advice when I was not wanting to pay a financial advisor back when I was a lot.
Free comes at its own cost, though. Free
Has a different...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, what is something that's more expensive than free?
Bad advice.
Well, bad advice or, yeah, incomplete advice, right? So, for example, I have a family member, I won't say which one, that refuses to pay for tax help. The person's taxes are very complicated, and I'm almost positive they cost themselves more money than if they just paid a CPA to do their taxes. There's nothing that I can do about it. This person's very stubborn, but they just like doing their own taxes. So it's just like, okay. But at the same time, like, I'm almost positive that you're costing yourself money, missing out on some complicated deductions based off of like certain kind of investment deductions that you're not taking advantage of. I mean, the way I look at things like back in the day is I was always focused on cost. That was my main concern, is like, how cheap is something? And then my mindset when I became a business owner switched a little bit more to like, what is the value? And I start seeing this stuff in my own personal life that way more too. Now I look at installing like some sort of thing on the wall in the house, and I'm just like, okay, would I rather do this myself and have it be like not aligned parallel to the floor and fall out in like a year, or like whatever, they just pay $100 to have it done really well. You know, I mean, it just, I guess it depends, right, on your mindset. But but that's an interesting one. Let's do another one. I think you said you had two stories for this.
Yeah, this plays to the tune of one of the loopholes we've talked about before, the pay repay loophole, where we've got spouses, both have student loan debt. One utilizes repay to keep their payment as low as possible via the proportionate payment calculation. and the other spouse taking advantage of pay on filing separately and keeping the payment based off of just their own income. So I had a case like this month where it actually made sense with IBR, income-based repayment, which isn't the lowest payment calculation, but neither one of them had access to pay, PAYE, because they both had loans prior to 2007.
October. So let's stop for a second, Megan, and just say, like, for our listeners, we're trying to come up with a great nickname for this loophole because it's helpful to talk about it. I mean, I've heard someone say the alphabet soup loophole. I've heard someone say I've come up with like the fighting spouses loophole. Maybe that's not the best thing to talk about in an era like people are all stuck at home. You know, I mean, the little weird there. So maybe like a marriage loophole, right? That's basically what it is, right?
It is. Yeah. When you're married, you have the decision on how you can file taxes, joint or separate. And this is literally just squeezing the last bit of efficiency out of what we could get out of a repayment plan. So,
yeah. The double debt marriage loophole.
Double debt. Oh, I like that. Double debt. Yeah.
Double debt marriage loophole. Because I guess double debt kind of implies that you both have debt.
Yeah. And that's what has to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like in general, can you just explain what you meant when you said that repay payments are proportional?
Right. Yeah. So repay, revised pay as you earn, that plan is one of the lowest payment calculations available in the Fed system. It's 10% of discretionary income. What it does is when you're married, it doesn't care if you file separately or not. It's going to base the payment off of household income. And if both of you have student loan debt, federal student loan debt, it will proportionalize the payment. Meaning if you have 20% of the debt load and you're on repay, your household payment of the household payment, your payment will be 20% of that. And your spouse will have the 80%. Because if they have 80% of the balance, that's where the rest of the proportion goes.
Can we just like give some numbers to this?
Yeah.
Let's pretend that I'm a teacher and I'm married to another teacher. And each of us makes $50,000, and together we make $100,000. Mm-hmm. And we'll say that my spouse has $50,000 of student loan debt, and I went to some professional school and decided I didn't want to do it anymore, and I quit, and I have $200,000 of student loan debt. Mm-hmm. So $200,000 of student loan debt, so I have 80% of the debt, and then my spouse has 20% of the debt. We have $100,000 of income, 10%. Of that, we'd probably get a deduction for our family size, right? So it wouldn't be $10,000. It wouldn't be 10% of 100,000. It'd be 10% of 100,000 minus 150% of the poverty line. Mm-hmm. Let's just say the monthly payment, we do all the math and we find out that it's, I don't know, let's keep the math easy, say like $800 a month. Mm-hmm. So how would that $800 a month payment be split if we filed jointly and we both did repay? What would the payment like roughly be?
Yep. So the spouse with 20% of the debt would have a payment of $160. So 20% of that 800 total. Spouse two with the larger portion of the debt, but much lower income, would have 640 going towards their student loans. So that would be how much their payment would be specifically.
Okay. And then, so that's if we're both on repay. Mm-hmm. I guess we're both eligible for PSLF, right? Because I said we're both teachers. Mm-hmm. But what would my payment be if we filed taxes separately? How would that change the payment?
Yeah. So if you filed separately and you kept the payment based off of just your own income, and let's say the teacher, again, makes $50,000, you know, their payment would be based off of $50,000 minus the poverty line still. It doesn't change the fact that you're still a family size of two or three. And so that payment, let's call it, I mean, what do you think would be a good estimate for $50,000?
Well, it's a $50,000. You said I get to double count the family size?
Yeah, that's another little interesting efficiency trick. If you file separately, both of you have to report your household size or your family size. It doesn't change the fact that you're a family size of two or three if you're filing separately. And so filing joint, it counts it once because it's looking at you as a unit.
But how's that legal for... Because my wife claimed the kids. I didn't claim the kids.
Doesn't matter. The family size with an income-driven plan is not the same definition as dependency status on tax filing. The question is very clear. It says what children live in your house and receive more than half of their income support from you. If that's true for both of you, you're supporting your children together, you can claim that family size at the same rate for each of you.
So in other words, it's asking how many people are in your family, not how many people are on your tax return.
Correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or how many people are under your profile for your tax. See the difference of what is the question ask versus what do you think it asks? It's not the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say 50,000. Am I doing repay now or am I on pay?
So the person with 50,000, their income is, again, well, I think we said that their income is about the same, but you know, the spouse who has 200,000 worth of student loan debt, they are going to get creamed with that proportionalized payment on repay. And so they would be the person, or they would be the spouse that after filing separately would take advantage of pay, because that would keep their payment based off of their own income and not the proportionalized payment for the household.
The person with the big debt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if they're a teacher and pursuing PSLF, I mean, that's the goal, to pay as little as possible to maximize forgiveness.
So, okay. So my payment, instead of $640 a month, it's now 10% of 50,000 minus 150% of the poverty line for family size of, let's say, two.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to mean probably a payment of around $200 a month.
Yeah, compared to what it was, $640.
What about the spouse, though? What about my spouse? Does she have to pay more than $160?
What's interesting is, no, they don't have to pay more than that. They can file separate. Of course, they both will have a separate tax return. But instead of that spouse going on pay, that spouse can stay on repay and keep that, because, you know, keep in mind, they make about the same income. On pay for spouse one with 200,000 of student loan debt, their payment's close to 200, 240. Spouse two with the same amount of income can take advantage of pay, having that proportional payment. You know, they only have 20% of the debt, so that household payment is going to be, their portion will be 20%, so they can keep the 180 payment. And so all across the board, we've achieved efficiency. We've dropped the payment down for the spouse who had 200,000 of debt from 640 to 240, let's say. And we kept spouse two's payment from being 240 by going on pay and filing separately to staying on repay and keeping the proportion down to 180.
So what you're saying is people out there with the sub $50,000 student loan balances need to update their eHarmony profiles about, you know, most attractive potential partner for those with high student loan debt and pursuing student loan forgiveness. Is that's kind of what I'm hearing. I don't know. Is eHarmony still the platform? I don't know. I'm a little out of the loop.
I don't think so.
I'm just kidding. I think, you know, what is it now? TikTok? Can people date on TikTok? I don't know.
I'm sure something's happened from TikTok.
Yeah. I don't know. So my youngest brother is the only one in my family that's single. So it's like quarantine's an interesting time. It's just like you can't really go out with anybody. So it's like you just talk to people all day, I guess. So that's really fascinating. So the double debt loophole, maybe we'll try to see if that sticks.
Yeah,
you know?
I like it.
But the double debt loophole, where basically you've got one spouse on pay, one spouse on repay. You're just taking advantage of math. You're taking advantage of proportional payments. And the fact that when you file separately, the payment is based off of one spouse's income alone. And then the other payment, if you're on the repay plan, is going to be joint regardless of your tax filing status. So that's how you get a lower overall combined payment.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fascinating. I bet you that's probably a loophole that probably 80, 90% of our listeners have not really thought about before.
Right. Well, I mean, it's definitely complicated. It's not readily like just a simple solution to maybe a repayment strategy, but it could definitely save some money.
Free advice, Megan. Free advice. I shouldn't pay. It's free.
Right.
The people on Reddit, they know me. They know me, Megan. They're going to be there for me when I make a mistake, and they're going to pay. They're going to help me out. Mm. I'm just being an idiot. So let's ask some more questions. What's another one? Maybe a different one.
I mentioned this in our consult meeting that we had, our consultant meeting we had recently. I've been getting a lot more consults for folks who are nearing retirement age. And I think that maybe because of this time of uncertainty we're in, folks who still have student loan debt or who have parent plus loans who are nearing retirement age or about to potentially enter retirement, walk away from their jobs, there's some uncertainty right now for sure. And, you know, if there's still debt lingering around, they're starting to want to make sure that they have a strategy for it because their income is likely about to be impacted or change in some way. So I had a double consolidation case. This is another little loophole we've talked about with Parent Plus loans, where traditionally, you know, parents who pull out loans for their kids to go to school, they only have access to either just an amortized plan within the Fed system where they spread that payment over 10 years or 15, 20, 25, 30, or they, if they consolidate, they have access to income contingent repayment. So an income-driven plan based off of 20% of discretionary income, which typically doesn't bring much relief in the form of a payment.
Can I just say something about the ICR plan real quick?
Yeah.
The ICR plan was the only plan available for income-driven plan available for student loans. It started in the 90s. Mm-hmm. This plan makes all the other plans look like...
simple.
Like, yeah, like a children's book, right? There's this complicated income multiplication factor when it's not based off of 20% of your income, right? You know, it's just so complicated. This ICR plan, it's just like, I see why nobody signs up for it because it's either 20% of your income with a deduction that's like way lower too. Like they don't mm-hmm. even give you a good deduction. They give you like just the poverty line instead of 150% of the poverty line. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these questions about like, do you want to repay your ICR loan jointly with your spouse that they ask? And man, it's just a mess. Like I see why people struggle. Like, especially like I see why people didn't sign up for income driven plans before IBR, just because this thing is just awful.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just wanted to make a vicious ad hominem attack on the ICR plan.
Right. It is a horrible plan. I agree. There are limited circumstances where I think that plan makes sense. But traditionally, that was the only income driven plan available for Parent Plus loans. So if they were pursuing PSLF or if they were pursuing longer term forgiveness, and if you call your servicer, they will tell you that's the only plan available for an income driven plan available for Parent Plus loans. Now, a process called double consolidation, we've talked about before on this podcast, it's where we change the loan code. We consolidate twice, where we're essentially wiping out the Parent Plus loan code in the loan flow. And that opens the door to repay, potentially pay IBR. It opens the door to other income-driven plans that could bring a lot of relief. It could potentially bring a shorter forgiveness timeline, like pay, for example, having a time frame of 20 years instead of 25, like repay or IBR. It was interesting. I had one case where she had paid for her daughter's college, single. She's nearing retirement age coming up in these next couple of years, but she still had a six-figure balance on these loans. And she, you know, her payment wasn't going very far. She felt like the balance was staying about the same. And it was because she was on a graduated repayment plan. And if you're not familiar with those repayment plans, what they do is they spread your, it's amortized. So they spread your payment out over, in her case, it was 25 years. In the very early years, the payment is very low. It's meant to maybe mimic income growth over time because the payment will increase every 2 years based off of that amortization schedule. And so it starts out really low, pretty attractive in the form of a payment, but it increases arbitrarily every 2 years. It's not based on income.
But that's a great idea because then we do those balloon mortgages during the housing crisis. Yeah. Like those worked out really well, right?
Exactly. And so that's exactly what it does. You front load the end, you're only paying interest in the very beginning of the first 5-10 years of that repayment plan. And so no wonder she felt like she was going nowhere because she wasn't. She was spinning her wheels.
How terrifying to have a ballooning payment going into retirement too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so she hadn't done anything with the loans. She hadn't consolidated them previously. She had just chosen the plan that she thought and her servicer thought was the best plan at that point in time when she initially started repayment. And so what we walked through was the double consolidation process where we take half of her loans, consolidate them with one servicer, the other half consolidate with a different servicer. Why we separate is we don't want them to be combined together. And if you sent them to the same servicer, that's what they would do. If you call your servicer and ask to consolidate loans separately, they'll question you. They're not going to know what you're talking about. They're not going to know why you're trying to do this. But we send them to two different servicers. They both consolidate within themselves. So what we have now is two direct consolidation loans. Now, the next step is key because, again, linguistics are very important. If we consolidate once, they are a direct consolidation loan that consolidated parent plus loans. They only have access to income contingent repayment as that is.
That's the bad one, right?
Correct. So what we do next is we then consolidate those two direct consolidation loans together into one. And now what we've done is we've created a consolidation that consolidated two direct consolidation loans. It wipes out the parent plus loan code.
Oh my gosh. That's like the Matrix. We should call that the Matrix loophole.
I like that. The Matrix loophole. So what that did do is it opened up the door to repay for her. Revised pay as you earn. So that's 10% of discretionary income. It has a 25-year forgiveness time frame, and she's about to enter retirement. So her income is about to drop a little bit based on what her active working income was going to look like. And so there was an end in sight, I guess you could say, with there being some kind of forgiveness threshold, and the payment was going to be so much less, you know, and it wasn't going to increase on her every 2 years like her original plan. So we saved money on just cash flow in general. We made sure that the payment was as low as we could possibly get it. And we just saved her from maybe a world of headache of being trapped in a plan that continuously increases over time throughout her retirement years when cash flow is very important. So I thought that was a really cool one.
Yeah, it is. The balance is going to increase because you're paying a small amount of money and the balance is going to grow. But that's okay. Like, I think I've actually called this previously the die with your debt loophole. Mm-hmm. And that's a little depressing. So like sometimes I don't like to use that one, right? But but actually people die with their debt all the time. If you think about, you know, the typical American, right? The typical American is just like middle class family. Most of their savings is in their house, right? They might have a little bit of money in retirement, but they run through that pretty quickly. When they do retire, most of their income's coming from Social Security. They run through all their savings and then they end up, if they live long enough in a nursing home, they don't have $80,000 a year to pay for a nursing home. So what happens, Medicaid, 2/3 of Medicaid actually is nursing home bills. So Medicaid is essentially a middle class nursing home entitlement is really what the majority of it is, even though you think of that as like the healthcare program for the poor. So that person might have a couple thousand or a few thousand of credit card debt. Well, in a lot of cases, when somebody passes away, credit card debt becomes uncollectible against an estate, right? I've read some articles in the past where like credit card companies will try to trick people in calling grieving loved ones to try to collect on this debt that they, you know, a collections agency bought for like pennies on the dollar because it's not collectible legally. And they just call anyway. And depending on what state you live in, like there's different consumer protection laws in different states. So, you know, maybe you go buy all the consumer debt in the state with loose consumer protection laws and you try to get these grieving people, survivors, right, to pay for out of their own pocket, maybe because dad had a, you know, a $5,000 credit card bill because he had Alzheimer's near the end of his life and didn't really know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's kind of sad. Like, I mean, it's kind of depressing to talk about, but like people dying with their debt is not unusual. Mm-hmm. That's pretty common. Like that's kind of the purpose of probate is to really expose your business to the world, to creditors, for them to make a claim against your estate. Except for federal student loans, we know that when someone passes, the loan's forgiven tax-free. Mm-hmm. So there's no implication for your heirs. There's no implication for your estate even in terms of you passing along money to heirs. So if you're already in your 50s or 60s and you're looking at a plan that allows you to put your payment on a 25-year type repayment plan, well, at the earliest, you're going to be, you know, in your 80s before you'd actually have to physically pay the tax bomb on this kind of debt. Mm-hmm. And then most likely every single new higher education act that comes along allows people the option of consolidating all their old debt and moving it to the new loan program, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So presumably what you could do is just consolidate another time to whatever the new repayment plan is for an extra 20 or 25 years when you owe the tax bomb, if you're really that concerned about it. Mm-hmm. Or you use the insolvency rule to basically say that your, you know, assets are lower than your liabilities. I love this story, Megan, because I think like what we're essentially trying to do is do the impossible, right? Yeah. We're trying to take somebody in their 50s or 60s who hasn't saved as much as they need for retirement and who has a huge amount of parent plus loans and achieve retirement without Social Security that have to work for another 25 years. Mm-hmm. But instead, we can encourage them to delay claiming Social Security until 70. And then they get a way higher benefit that covers living expenses in a big way. And then we can, you know, maybe encourage them to seek out a, you know, financial planner to talk about why it makes sense to spend all their assets basically down before they get Social Security so they can avoid taking Social Security early. And then they can retire before age 70. And then if they think about their debt as a tax rather than a debt, well, then this person can essentially be giving this massive inheritance to their children courtesy of the United States government.
Right.
Right. I mean, because that's really what it is. It's like you borrowed $200,000 for two or three of your kids to go to school. And instead of paying it back directly and working till 80, instead of that, you're going to make the right decision for you. And, you know, I think that's really what it's about. Like a lot of people will get all angry about that. Oh, you should pay your debt back. You borrowed it. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not going to be the ones that are going to be there for you when you're driving into the office at age 78.
Right. Yeah.
Ignore the haters and like live the life that is your best life.
Well, and we're just taking advantage of things that are available. Like these are legitimate things that we can take advantage of and leverage in our favor. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's, you know, leverage and efficiency and financial planning is so important. And if we can take advantage of that in any way for someone's repayment plan, let's do it. Why waste money if we can be more efficient?
Well, it's just like the tax bill is going to come for us all regardless of what you do. Mm-hmm. So realize that, right? Like whenever I talk to people about they're concerned about loan forgiveness, or they think it's not the right thing to do morally or something. Well, think about it this way. Every single one of us is taking on the higher debt burden from all of these poorly designed student loan plans, mm-hmm. right? Or student loan forgiveness programs. I don't think it matters what your politics are. Like, I think everyone can agree the student loan system that we have is a mess.
Yeah.
Either you think people should pay back more of their debt so that costs could be lower at higher education institutions and that you don't like that part, or you're like, well, student loans should just be straight up forgiven because it'd be so much cheaper instead of the mess that we have now. So it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. And the thing is, you can either take advantage of the rules legally, mm-hmm. and do things, everything in, you know, in your power to give yourself the best chance of financial success, or you can kind of say, oh, this system's immoral, and it's kind of like the cranky sit on your front porch and get mad at the world strategy, right? It's like, it's helpful emotionally, but it doesn't help you financially. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of seeing a little bit of that with like the stimulus plan right now, the stimulus acts.
Yeah.
It's like everybody's upset at the public companies for taking all the money. Mm-hmm. You just got to focus on what you can control, because you can get so mad and just seethe in anger all day, every day, and it's just not going to help anything.
Exactly.
Like I watched this last kind of random Travis rant. That's probably a lie too, but I'm just going to say, it's like I watched Apollo 13 the other day. Like I've been really into apocalypse movies. Like, I don't know if you're, what you're watching on Netflix, Megan, but
I try not to scare myself too much. I have not been doing that.
Yeah. And Apollo 13, it wasn't even on Netflix. I had to rent it or buy it because it's the 50th anniversary of Apollo 13. And I got to meet Jim Lovell as a kid. So he's kind of like a hero, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyways, one of the things they do is they're blaming each other at one point over like who stirred the oxygen tanks and caused the explosion that caused the whole mess. They're all arguing about it. And then Tom Hanks just goes, we are not going to do this right now because we're just going to be right back where we started in the first place with the same freaking problems. And I thought that was a great analogy for anything that makes you upset. You're just going to end up right in the same exact original place where you have the same problems. Mm-hmm. So focus on solving the problem and not on assigning blame or trying to, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But do we have some other stories? Sorry, golly, I really rant too much, don't I?
You're fine. You're passionate.
The listeners, y'all are the real MVP.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll round it out with just one more, maybe, I guess, normal case, like nothing super exciting about no PSLF, no double consolidation, no crazy loophole, but just taking advantage of the system, how it's designed. Had one case this month where I had someone call in with their mom on the phone. They recently graduated and they just completed their exit interview with school. And if it's been a while since you've graduated, you know, that's basically where they sit you down in the counselor's office. They tell you about repay specifically, or they blast your eardrums with all the different, there's 9 technically different income, well, not income, but different federal student loan repayment plans available. They give you a very high level, quick talk about it. and then they send you on your way. They make you create your online account with your servicer and they say good luck. And it was not funny, but you know, she was telling me about how, you know, she was asking, well, what's best for me to consider? Like, what's best for my situation? And of course, the counselors are not going to answer those questions. They're not planners. They don't have a finance background typically. And so she felt confused. She felt like she just got dumped, or she had what is that term? Like when someone just dumps information on you. I feel like there's a saying for that.
Information overload or
something like that. Yeah.
Word vomit or something.
Yeah. It was almost like the counselor word vomited all over her what she could do, but wouldn't give any guidance or feedback on what she should do. And so she called, you know, she set up a consult with us to help navigate repayment. And her mom was very adamant about paying this off. She was adamant about, and this person has close to $200,000 in student loan debt and making about $50,000, and probably her career will cap out at about $90,000 a year. Her mom was very adamant about her staying home, paying this all off.
Living at home.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, living at home. So of course the daughter may not have been down with that for the long term, but yeah, we walked through it because I used to teach Dave Ramsey courses. A college buddy of mine and I, you know, did that at his church here in Atlanta. So I like the mentality about not having consumer debt and just having a good approach towards your finances and generally being against debt. You know, when it comes to student loan debt, that's just federal student loans are not traditional debt. They're just not. And so we can't treat them like traditional debt. When people are graduating with mortgage size loan balances, it's still going to take you 15, 20, 25 years to pay this all off with every dollar, every extra dollar you have coming in of income. And what are you going to have to show for it when you've focused all your time and resources into this student loan debt? You're going to have a $0 net worth because we didn't save. This debt didn't return anything to you. It's not an asset that you can turn around and sell. It doesn't have equity within it. So I walked through that because I respect Dave Ramsey. I think he's built an empire of his own. I just think when it comes to student loan debt, he's very dead wrong. And so we walked through like the opportunity cost of, you know, if you had an extra $1,000 a month, because that was the difference between the income-driven plan she was looking at and what it would take to potentially refinance, which I would absolutely not recommend now, but for conversational purposes, we talked about, you know, what it would be looking like compared to refinancing at a lower interest rate, how much she'd have to commit to for the next 25 years to pay it off. And it was $1,000 difference per month in a payment generally. And I asked her, I said, what could you be doing with that $1,000 if it wasn't going towards student loan debt? You know, that's the opportunity cost you're running up against, because you can save that, invest that, put that towards moving out, put that towards retirement. So I felt like that one was a really good call, because I think we talked through just the concept of better, more efficient student loan planning, and nothing sexy about it. It was just taking advantage of an income-driven plan versus amateurizing the balance. And it still worked out to be the best, I think, in her situation.
A lot of times you just take a parent that has a son or daughter that they want to pay the loan back in full. And then you can just convince the parent by just saying, well, there's two strategies. There's the no grandchildren strategy and the grandchildren strategy. Right. Which one would you like to do? I mean, because paying $2,000 a month on a $50,000 income is 100% guaranteed the non-grandchildren strategy. Alternatively, you could also view it as the marry for money, not for love strategy.
Right.
Or maybe the person just needs to go find one of those super attractive 30K debt, 50K income teachers out there that had no idea that they're the perfect student loan borrower for the double debt loophole.
Yes.
To be combined with a high debt to income ratio person out there, right? So that's kind of a funny one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, overall, if we're talking about different kinds of savings levels, right? One kind of person just wants to get confirmation they're doing the right thing. And sometimes they are. And we just confirm that. And there's value in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then another kind of person, we find them, you know, 10-ish thousand in projected savings because we speed up their getting access to the repay plan, or we speed up interest subsidies, or we correct one thing about, you know, a couple tax filing separately statuses that they did that they can amend and get that money back, right? So it's, I would say, like a mild mistake. And then there's correcting significant mistakes, like filing taxes the wrong way, or being on the wrong plan, or having loans that were not set up to be forgiven that should have been set up to be forgiven, like with a 20-year plan. Mm-hmm. So those are your $50,000 type mistakes. And then your six-figure mistakes is, like you mentioned, somebody didn't understand income-driven repayment. Somebody didn't understand PSLF, didn't know that they qualified for it. You know, so there's really different levels of mistakes that go into that average total projected savings per person that we quote sometimes. So, you know, it includes zeros, it includes 200,000s, right? It includes a lot of different numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just really fascinating. Last couple questions. If I had to ask, what are your top concerns with implementation of the CARES Act with, you know, student loans and everything? I guess mine, I'm curious what yours are. Mm-hmm. Mine are that they're going to try to capitalize people's interest, even though it explicitly says that they're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people come out of this forbearance, my guess is at least one servicer will have a massive screw up and will capitalize it because all their internal systems are set up the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to spend months undoing it. I'm pretty confident that eventually they'll get it right and not capitalize anyone's interest that is exiting this national forbearance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
That would be a mess.
At least they have a while to work on it.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, you don't see that interest capitalized until you exit a forbearance if it does capitalize. So at least they have until, you know, October the 30th is the first payment on most people's NSLDS forms, I'm noticing, because September 30th is the date that the forbearance ends. Basically, everybody's going to start their payment, it seems like, all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of auto debits, at least they have a while to work on it. So that's what I'll say is I'm hopeful that they won't capitalize the interest. That was one of our original concerns with just how they're going to implement that.
Right. And as long as they have a process, I mean, I think it'll be fine. But yeah, it's written in the language. So if that's something you see come that time, speak up, say something. It wasn't supposed to happen. And probably recognizing that they need to fix it if it has.
Right, right. And the other big concern is we've seen some language out there where they're saying, thank you for submitting your IDR application. We will process this once the national forbearance ends or something like that, right?
Right.
So walk through kind of our concerns on that one.
Yeah. So the thought process, what was really attractive about this was that these months of paused payments were going to count towards forgiveness timelines. So PSLF, the longer term forgiveness timelines. But the language does specifically say you had to have been in repayment on an income-driven plan and, of course, qualifying in all other areas prior to September 13th. And so a lot of people were, but if someone jumped the gun, I guess you could say, or went ahead and put their loans into forbearance because they had an impact to their income or they just weren't sure, my question is, you know, if they, and what I've been thinking makes sense, is if they were to re-enter repayment, you know, by either recalculating their payment or recertifying, does that kick them into repayment status where those payments will count going forward? I think that's the best bet, but does it actually? And I don't think we'll know that until people are able to file like their employer certification forms to see if these months have counted, if that was the boat they were in.
Yeah. So listeners out there, especially people that are graduating and are consolidating their loans to get onto an income-based plan as fast as possible to get PSLF credit, what we would love is for people to do that, and then they'll make their first payment probably like that would count towards PSLF maybe in July, and then to submit an ECF form, an employer certification form, immediately after that, and then just tell us what they tell you. I mean, it probably will take a month for them to get back to you, and then we'll be close to the end of the CARES Act student loan freeze if they don't do a 2.0, which I think is a big if. I think they probably will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing that we haven't talked about is like whether or not they're going to extend September the 30th. I think that's a big question mark.
Yeah.
It just depends on so many things. Like if we keep economic progress going and like, you know, the craziness calms down and the economies start reopening and we don't see a whole lot of people die because of it. And then more economies start reopening because of the pressure everybody's feeling from that. And things are starting to get not back to normal, but just not as bad. Then I think that you might see people just say, oh, let's just let the thing expire, you know. But I just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just hard to say. Yeah, so I think the way I read that is if you were not on an IDR plan, we'll apply, and then like they're not going to use that to calculate your payment until after this is over. That's the way I interpret it.
Yeah.
Is you should get credit for everything. And we're giving people the best advice that we can with this great uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And the good news is, like, you couldn't have done anything better than what we're going to tell people to do.
Yeah. That's, I guess, the positive is that ideally those payments count. If they don't, no harm lost, because you weren't required to make a payment. You shouldn't be making payments if you are. And interest is at zero. So it doesn't really hurt you if that's not the case, but it would be ideal if, of course, they do count.
Well, there was harm, but there was just nothing you could have done about
it. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's a better way to put it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, first of all, everyone listening to this, don't panic. Like everything counts, right? If you are on an income-driven plan as of March 13th and you didn't do anything except for ask for a forbearance or receive one, then 100% everything counts between now and September 30th. Yep. That's not what we're saying.
Right.
We're talking about people who they were in school as of March 13th and they graduated after that, or they were in a non-related forbearance before that, you know, and then they were in an economic hardship forbearance on March 13th from a year ago or something. Those are the people that were kind of like, how is this going to work? Like from a processing standpoint, from a servicer standpoint. So I guess basically like what you should know is we try to ask these hard, weird questions months before they end up showing up in our inboxes, because we're trying to predict the problems that will arise based off of like our knowledge of the servicers and how they're going to process things and what kind of issues are going to show up. So that's part of the fun thing that y'all don't get to see is we have team meetings every few weeks where all the consultants will come together and we'll just talk about problems. What are you seeing? What's working well? What rumors are you hearing? What servicers are saying what about this thing? What weird requests for more additional documents have you gotten from servicers this week, right? So that way everyone stays on top of all the latest developments and we help each other out and make sure everybody's getting the same playbook versus differing opinions, right? So we all try to stay on the same page that way. Well, cool. Well, that's a treasure trove of information, Megan. Do you have any kind of last tips or stories you want to share?
Well, I do have a last. I thought of it when we were wrapping up, so this is out of place, but I thought of another success story that's not really student loan. I mean, it's student loan related, but it's not the savings they achieved in their student loan payment. It was the savings they achieved with their tax filing. Community property states, they're interesting. When you file separately in a community property state via the 50-50 income split, it divides income down the middle. It minimizes your tax implication. Of course, depending on your tax situation in general, but generally what we found is it minimizes your tax implication by filing separately. So we're not a community property state here in Georgia. And so filing separately here could have more tax implications than filing in like Texas, for example, or California. But I consulted with a couple who had been filing separately in a community property state for years, but they had not been doing the income split correctly. They were going to like H&R Block. They were just separating income. One spouse made $200,000. The other spouse made like $25,000 because she was part-time. And they were paying thousands of dollars in tax consequences for not having that income split done correctly. So I told them, I said, hey, go double check that. See what the difference would be if you split the income correctly. Maybe go back and amend your taxes, recoup some of that tax benefit. And they indeed got... it was nuts. They were paying, you know, close to $15,000 in tax implications. Yeah. And it was minimal when they went back and amended it, which was crazy. So definitely do your due diligence, double checking even maybe your CPA, especially if your CPA is not familiar with filing separately in a community property state via, it's the 8958 form. IRS 8958 form that divides income in half. And, you know, just double check, look at your tax return. If you've been filing separate in a community property state and you see your own income reflected on your tax return and your spouse's own income on their tax return, you are likely leaving a lot of tax dollars on the table. We found that to be true here recently.
Yeah. It's like, why do financial advisors not give good student loan advice? It's because they don't do it very often.
Yeah. And they don't know what they're looking for.
Right. And why do CPAs file people's married filing separate returns at community property states wrong a lot of the time when they're freaking CPAs? It's because they don't do it a lot of the time, because married filing separately is rarely a route to tax savings. So if your job is to minimize tax savings, that is the point of your job. You're not going to file a lot of separate returns. It's probably our CPA on our team, Ben, he said that that's probably 1% of returns are married filing separate. Mm-hmm. So 1 in 100 times. So in that case, a lot of CPAs, especially ones that are like small shops, they're just not going to know that rule. Mm-hmm. They're just not going to be familiar with it. And they're not going to understand why somebody's doing it for student loan purposes.
Yeah.
Realize that you might even be getting incorrect tax advice because you're a student loan borrower, which mm-hmm. is also kind of nuts, right? So we don't do people's taxes for them, but we do is tell them, you know, based off your student loans, this is what your tax filing strategy probably should be. And mm-hmm. then, you know, go verify the numbers with an accountant. But that's a great loophole. That's a great suggestion. Double check the advice, get a second opinion, right? So I'll say this, I am pleasantly surprised that y'all are still booking consults in a big way. But I guess it makes sense because, first of all, because we're in a pandemic, that's why I'm surprised. Like, people are losing their incomes and losing their jobs. Like, I get why people would maybe be a little bit more cautious about what they're spending right now. But at the same time, there's still massive amounts of ways to save money, right? So Megan, like, the loopholes that you mentioned are not time dependent, mm-hmm. right? So none of the discussions that we've had today of success stories, none of them are in any way impacted by the short-term freeze of student loan payments and interest from the CARES Act because of the coronavirus pandemic recession. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the importance of why it makes sense to get a plan in the first place. And then also why now is still a good time. That's pleasantly surprising to see people realize that from the perspective of keeping all the lights on and keep pumping out content for you. And then I appreciate that for all of you that have continued to tell your friends about us, continue to tell people about the podcast. If you just enjoy the podcast and you share that with a friend, that helps us out in a big way. So thank you. And thank you to all of our healthcare workers, like my wife out there, that are sacrificing in a big way. And just stay safe. And if we can help you, we'd love to. Go to studentloanplanner.com/help. Anything to add, Megan?
No, be safe. Stay healthy out there. Stay positive. And we're going to get through this.
Yeah, definitely don't listen to any of my weird jokes. Those will depress you. So if you know you need a long-term plan, especially also if you're a recent grad, you know, I think a lot of recent grads make a lot of mistakes with this. And the sooner you get a plan, you know, people ask me a lot of times, when's the right time to set up a plan? The answer is as soon as you can afford it, right? And two is as soon as you can, because the sooner you get the right plan, the more money you're going to save long term. So for the recent grads out there, I would say definitely start getting analysis done so we can make sure that you're set up the right way for the future. But anyway, have a great week, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. And also, if you have questions you want to ask on the podcast, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We'd love to get some more of your questions for future shows. Everyone, take care, stay safe, and we will make it through this.